Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 20, which I will entitle A Sign Against Egypt and Cush. Cush, I will assume, is Ethiopia. Some people say there's an alternate site in Arabia somewhere, but we're going to say Ethiopia. That seems to be the majority opinion. Now, in chapters 18 and chapters 19, the previous two chapters, we've been talking about Isaiah's oracles concerning Cush, Ethiopia, and Egypt. They were allied because a Cushite king, Terheka by name, had come up from Ethiopia, from Cush, and had conquered Egypt. And so the Pharaoh was now an Ethiopian. So we're going to consider Egypt and Cush together. We start now in Isaiah 20, verses 1 through 2. In the year that the supreme commander sent by Sargon, who ruled from 722 to 705, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod and attacked and captured it. At that time the Lord spoke through Isaiah, son of Amoz. He said to him, "Take off the sackcloth from your body and the sandals from your feet." And he did so, going around stripped and barefoot. Now Isaiah mentions a specific year in verse 1. He says, "In the year that the supreme commander sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod." Well, we know from Assyrian history that Ashdod was attacked somewhere 711 BC or so, right in the middle of Sargon's reign. That's the same Sargon II who destroyed Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, in 722 BC and took the northern 10 tribes off into exile. So this is just a mere 11 years later. Now, going from Ashdod to the siege of Jerusalem is a little bit of history. I'm going to give you the political background here from a site that did a good job of summarizing it, varchive.com. Quote, "With Samaria's fall," that's 722 BC, "the last stronghold of opposition to Assyria was extirpated. Not only did Egypt lose all of its remaining influence in Asia, its last Libyan rulers were themselves compelled to submit to Assyrian overlordship. By Sargon's seventh year," that would be about 715 or so BC, "Piru, the king of Musru," which is translated as Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is listed among those sending tribute to Assyria. So Assyria is the top dog in Palestine following the 722 attack on Samaria. Later in the same year, a certain Yamani seized power in Ashdod, an independent principality next to Judah on the coast. This was a Philistine principality. And this Yamani tried to organize anti-Assyrian opposition and anti-Assyrian league and to enroll the help of Egypt. He, as Sargon recounts in his annals, sent bribes to Piru, king of Musru, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, a potentate incapable to save him, and asked him to be an ally. The rebellious prince, that's Yamani of Ashdod. Ashdod, of course, is a Philistine city on the Mediterranean coast down there toward the southwest. The rebellious prince Yamani tried also to involve Judah in the conspiracy, but Hezekiah, probably at Isaiah's urging, refused to risk the nation's fate on so doubtful a venture. Informed of Yamani's revolt, Sargon gathered chosen troops and sent them against the rebel. In a sudden rage, I marched quickly against Ashdod, his royal residence. Without Egyptian help, the outcome was not long in doubt. The Assyrian king looted the rebellious city along with other towns on the Philistine coast. Yamani fled into the territory of Egypt, which belongs now to Ethiopia. So all of that happened right around 715 to 711 BC. As Jameson Fawcett and Brown, Ashdod, the biblical Azotus, that city's still there now. It's got an oil depot that ships oil that's transshipped across the Negev Desert from the east, like from India, places like that, across the Negev, and from there it's transported from Ashdod to the rest of Europe on the Mediterranean Sea. Ashdod was one of the five cities of the Philistines. The taking of it, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, was a necessary preliminary to the invasion of Egypt, to which it was the key in that quarter, the Philistines being allies of Egypt. Yes, well, Ashdod's right on the road down to Egypt, the coast road there. And so the Egyptians are asked to help this rebel king of Ashdod, Yamani, and the Egyptians refuse. And so Ashdod is kaputsky. Now, when did this happen? Ellicott says it's in Sargon's 11th year. This V-Archive said the tribute was being sent from Egypt in the seventh year of Sargon's reign, which would be about 715. But the revolt was about 711, says Ellicott. Commentator Guzik says it's 711. He doesn't give a reason why, but I'm pretty sure that's standard. So This is when Isaiah has his sign, which is taking off his sackcloth from his body and his sandals from his feet. Now, Sargon II did not personally take Ashdod. The supreme commander of the Assyrian army took Ashdod. That's the NIV translation. The King James, the Holman Christian Study Bible, has the Assyrian name transcribed Tartan. A little bit later, in 701, past 711, in 701, the king of Assyria sent Tartan. That's Sennacherib sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris and the Rabshakeh, to Jerusalem. And, of course, those are not proper names. Those are names of offices, like we would say the general, the colonel, the secretary of state, secretary of defense. Now, this Sargon, who ruled from 722 to 705, has a real Assyrian name. Sharrukin was his Assyrian name. Sargon is how the Hebrews rendered it. This is the only mention of Sargon II in the scriptures. The old commentators, most of whom I used, did know who he was. He was generally thought to be the same as Sennacherib. Some would say Shalmaneser, who came right before Sargon II. Sennacherib came after Sargon II, and since he was a gap there, the commentators didn't know who he was. But then, of course, more Assyrian monuments were discovered, and then everybody now knows who Sargon II is. If I remember correctly, that used to be an apologetic problem, because liberals would always say, well, who's this Sargon? Well, then all of a sudden they found his name written all over the place. As Ellicott says, much light has been thrown by the Assyrian inscriptions on the events connected with this king, Sargon II. Prior to that discovery, there was no trace of his name to be found elsewhere than in this passage, and his very existence had been called in question. As it is, he comes before us as one of the greatest of Assyrian monarchs. He succeeded Shalmaneser V, the conqueror of Israel, in B.C. 721, or say 722, close enough, as first as guardian and co-regent of his sons Hamdan-Malek, and afterwards in his own name. His reign lasted till B.C. 704. The modern dates have it 720 to 705 instead of 721 to 704. The chronologists, of course, refine their dates as time goes on. And then he was succeeded by Sennacherib. Now, we're going to get to Sennacherib and Hezekiah. Great story. But right now, we're at the siege of Ashdod. Ellicott describes the siege. The occasion of the campaign is related by Sargon in the annals just mentioned as happening in his 11th year. That's where we get 711. 722 minus 11 is 711. Azuri, the king of Ashdod, refused to pay tribute and revolted. Sargon deposed him and placed his brother Akhismet on the throne. The people, in their turn, rose against Akhismet and chose Yaman as their king. Sargon then marched against the city, took it, and carried off its goods and its treasures as booty. These events naturally excited the minds of Hezekiah and his counselors and led them to look to an alliance with Egypt as their best protection. And, of course, Hezekiah doesn't want. And, of course, Isaiah doesn't want Hezekiah to ally with Egypt, because God knows that Egypt is about to get whooped by Assyria, as we see. We're going to take this story all the way down from 711 to 663 B.C., and by 663 we will see Egypt devastated by the Assyrians. Now, before we go to verse 2, let me point out that Ashdod was a very well-fortified city. In fact, later on, under an Egyptian pharaoh called Psamtik I, or Psammeticus, he besieged that city for 29 years before he got it. Another interesting fact is that Ashdod's fall in 711 is described in the cuneiform inscriptions of Sargon II. That's according to varchive.org. Now, the siege was started in 711, but there's a little bit of difficulty in determining how long it took to take the city, how long the Tartan, the supreme commander of Assyria, lay against Ashdod before he managed to take it is not mentioned anywhere. Now in verse 2, Isaiah 20, Isaiah says, at that time the Lord spoke through Isaiah son of Amoz. He said to him, God said to Isaiah, take off the sackcloth from your body and the sandals from your feet. And Isaiah did so. He went around stripped and barefoot. Now, there's two questions we have to investigate here when we get to verse 3, and that is, why did Isaiah have to strip his sackcloth off his body and the sandals from his feet for 3 years? That's a long time. But before we get there, let's asked the question, what is this sackcloth? Why is Isaiah wearing it? Well, he could be still in mourning over what happened to northern Israel in 722 when Sargon II wiped out the capital of northern Israel, Samaria. Or, more likely, I think he's wearing sackcloth for grief over what's happening now, as he prophesies in 711, when Ashdod has been taken. Now, I don't think he cared that much about Ashdod. That was a Philistine city, but it meant that the Assyrians were gaining power over Israel, and Israel was in a heap of trouble. We go now to Isaiah 20, verses 3 through 4. Then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has gone stripped and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and portent against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away stripped and barefoot the Egyptian captives and Cushite exiles, young and old, with buttocks bared to Egypt's shame. Now, our first tendency here is to think that this occurred at the siege of Ashdod in 711, but it didn't. There's no evidence of that in the archaeological record. So whatever happens against Egypt and Cush, Egypt and Ethiopia, is going to happen later. And there's plenty of archaeological evidence for that under the later two kings, Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But now let's talk about this stripped and barefoot for 3 years. Now that time has been locked down for us in verse 1 at the time that Ashdod was taken by Sargon. So this is in 711. Isaiah goes around stripped and barefoot for 3 years. Now, when we say stripped, that doesn't mean he was totally naked, of course. No man can go 3 years totally naked. It just meant he took off his upper garment. The symbolism of that is, just as Isaiah stripped, likewise the Egyptians and Ethiopians would be stripped of their valuables and be carried captive into Assyria, as Barnes, the commentator, says, and we'll see in just a minute. Now, let's go to the two issues I told you we had to look at. First of all, how long was it that Isaiah walked around stripped and barefoot? Now, it says 3 years, but that's not as easy as it seems. Well, let me give you some options that the commentators give us. It could be 3 days. As Clark states, quote, it is probable, therefore, that the prophet was ordered to walk so for 3 days to denote the accomplishment of the event in 3 years, a day for a year, according to the prophetical rule. So Isaiah only went stripped and barefoot for 3 days, according to Clark. Alfred Barnes also mentions this option, but the problem with that is that it's true that a day is often put for a year in the Old Testament, but not vice versa. Here we have a year put for a day. As Joseph Benson mentions, this is a problem, so I don't like that option. Now here's another option. Isaiah went naked and barefoot, or stripped and barefoot, for 3 years, but only at intervals during those 3 years. He might go for a month and wear his clothes, and 6 months later he'll be stripped and barefoot for another 2 weeks. I find that unlikely. Jameson, Foster, and Brown goes with that option. Barnes mentions that option. A gentleman named Wolfe, quoted in the dispensationalist commentator Guzik, says that Isaiah went around stripped and barefoot for part of each day for 3 years. That seems a little bit more likely. Fourth option is that there's no reference at all to Isaiah's actions, no proof that he actually went around for 3 years. He's just talking about, Isaiah is, what happened to Egypt and Cush, and we'll talk about that in a minute. 3 years, something happened to Egypt and Cush, but Isaiah didn't go around stripped and barefoot for 3 years. Now here's what Barnes says, quote, the Hebrew does not necessarily require this, what I just said, that Isaiah went around naked and barefoot for 3 years. The Hebrew does not necessarily require it. It may mean simply that his actions were a sign and wonder with reference to a 3 years captivity of the Egyptians. And Barnes says that it is highly improbable that Isaiah would be giving a sign for 3 years, because if the Assyrians were indeed advancing in 711 toward Ashdod, that would be scary for Israel. If that were true, then decided action was needed. So Barnes translates it this way. My servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot, a 3 year sign and wonder. In other words, he didn't walk naked and barefoot for 3 years, but he walked naked and barefoot, and this walking naked and barefoot was a sign and wonder that something was going to happen in 3 years, or for 3 years. And so it was just a brief period of time, according to Barnes, that Isaiah walked naked. Now, that's all very interesting, but that's a minor issue, in my opinion, as to how long it was that Isaiah actually went stripped and barefoot. The interesting question is as to what does this three-year period signify? Well, what does this three-year sign signify? I'm going to give you three options. Option one, 3 years after 711, Egypt and Ethiopia would be beaten by the Assyrians. In other words, they attack in 711 and it takes 3 years to knock down Egypt and Ethiopia. And of course, the problem with that is this is a siege on Ashdod, and Egypt and Ethiopia are not allied with Ashdod at this time. They tried to get the alliance, but they didn't have it. And even worse than that, there's no evidence that Assyria under Sargon II ever beat Egypt and Cush, and this was a prophecy against Egypt and Ethiopia. So I don't think that's going to work. Here's option number two, 3 years after 711, after the attack begun on Ashdod, Ashdod would be beaten by the Assyrians. But the problem with that is that Egypt and Ethiopia were not allied with Ashdod when Ashdod went down. But in verse 3 says this sign, this three-year sign, was a sign against Egypt and Cush. So how can it be a sign against Egypt and Cush when Egypt and Cush were not even involved in the siege of Ashdod? Well, here's a possible solution. One could say that the sign was against Egypt and Cush, not in the sense that Egypt and Cush got defeated in battle, but it was against Egypt and Cush because Isaiah is saying, Israel, don't ally with Egypt and Cush. They want you to, but don't do it. And 3 years later, after the siege of Ashdod, when you see Ashdod go down, you're going to realize it was a good thing you didn't ally yourself with Egypt and Cush. Well, here's option number three. This is from the pulpit commentary, which says that the three-year period ran probably from B.C. 713 to B.C. 711, or during the whole of the time that Philistia, Edom, Moab, and Judah were making representations to the Egyptians and Ethiopians and endeavoring to obtain their aid. In other words, their aid against the Assyrians. And so Isaiah is saying, okay, I'm in sackcloth and ashes because you're trying to get aid from Egypt and Cush, and it's not going to work. And then, see there, after the three-year period is over, Ashdod goes down to the Assyrians. So what good would it have done to ally with Egypt and Cush? The Philistines tried it, and they went down. Now, that to me makes more sense. Now, once again, this three-year sign was against Egypt and Cush, but it's Ashdod that goes down. I would solve that problem by saying it's a prophecy against Egypt and Cush in the sense that Isaiah was against Egypt and Cush. He didn't want Judah to ally herself with Egypt and Cush. And like in all prophecy, I think that people who are living through the events can interpret prophecy a lot better than we can who are not living through the events, because they can see it unfold before their eyes. We don't have that advantage. Now in verse 4, Isaiah says, the king of Assyria will lead away, stripped and barefoot, the Egyptian captives and Cushite exiles. Well, when did that happen? Well, it did not happen at the siege of Ashdod. Ashdod is not Egypt, and there were no Egyptian and Cushites in Ashdod. So when did it happen? Well, the period from 673 to 663 is when the Assyrians beat Egypt. And so we need to look to that period to see the fulfillment of verse 4, Isaiah 20. Now here's the historical background. I'm using Wikipedia for this. Quote, the Egyptians and Cushites had begun agitating peoples within the Assyrian Empire in an attempt to gain a foothold in the region. As a result, in 701 B.C., Hezekiah of Judah, Lula, king of Sidon, Sidka, king of Ascalon, and the king of Ekron formed an alliance with Egypt against Assyria. Now, of course, Isaiah didn't want Hezekiah to form an alliance with Egypt, but he did. Sidon and Ascalon and Ekron, of course, are two of the famous five Philistine cities. Sidon is the famous Lebanese city, a Phoenician city, on the coast of the Mediterranean north of Israel. And the time frame that Wikipedia is looking at here is in 701, which is a little bit later than 711, when Ashdod was taken and when Isaiah was giving this prophecy. But we get down to 701, the Neo-Assyrian ruler Sennacherib, who ruled from 705 to 681, attacked the rebels, conquering Ascalon, Sidon, and Ekron, and defeating the Egyptians and driving them from the region. And so, of course, now Hezekiah of Judah is in a world of trouble because all of his surrounding territory has been taken over by the Assyrians. And then Sennacherib marched toward Jerusalem, destroying 46 towns and villages, including the heavily defended city of Lachish, in his path. And we'll talk about that when we get there, Sennacherib's invasion. But right now, we're interested in what happens after Sennacherib, after 701 B.C. We get down to Esarhaddon, who ruled from 681 to 669. This, again, is from Wikipedia. He invades Egypt. He attacks Taharqa of Egypt in 677. Now, Taharqa is an Ethiopian monarch who had conquered Egypt, so that's why we get the reference from Isaiah of the Cushites and the Egyptians. They were allied together. In fact, the Ethiopians were actually the pharaohs of Egypt, so they're very hard to divide in this period. So, Esarhaddon of Assyria attacks Taharqa, the Cushite, the pharaoh of Egypt, in 677. He then invaded Egypt in 673. Unfortunately for him, he got beaten badly. However, Esarhaddon, having learned from his mistakes, came back and attacked Egypt again in 671. Well, Taharqa, the former Cushite pharaoh, the Ethiopian who had taken over Egypt, he's now been run out of Egypt by Esarhaddon of Assyria. Taharqa reoccupies Memphis, the southern city on the Nile in Upper Egypt. He also reoccupies the Delta in Lower Egypt in the north near the Mediterranean Sea. This is in 669. So he's basically taken over Egypt again. Well, Esarhaddon is not going to stand pat. He marches back to Egypt. Unfortunately, he dies on the way in 669. Well, Ashurbanipal, the next Assyrian king, takes over in 668. He ruled down to 627. And the next year after he takes over in 667, he beats Taharqa, the Cushite Ethiopian pharaoh. Well, after some time, Taharqa, the Ethiopian pharaoh, dies, and his son, Tantamani, takes over. And Tantamani, of course, is down in Ethiopia. They've been run out of Egypt. The Assyrians are ruling Egypt at this time. Ashurbanipal is. He's not there, but Assyria is ruling Egypt. And Tantamani, the Cushite, invades Egypt, trying to take Egypt back over from the Assyrians. Well, Ashurbanipal in 663 B.C. says, I've had enough of that. He comes back to Egypt and he beats Tantamani. So from 673 to 663, we see the Assyrians under Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal invading and more or less embarrassing Egypt and Cush. There are some setbacks for the Assyrians along and along, but overall, they beat them pretty badly. So now, with that history in the background, so in Isaiah 20, verse 4, we read, so the king of Assyria will lead away, stripped and barefoot, the Egyptian captives and Cushite exiles with their bare butts. Now, when did this happen? Well, in one of those attacks of Esarhaddon on Egypt, the one that happened in 671, we read this in Wikipedia. In 671 B.C., Esarhaddon took and sacked Memphis, where he captured numerous members of the royal family. This is Taharqa's royal family. Although the pharaoh Taharqa had escaped to the south, Esarhaddon captured the pharaoh's family, including his son and wife, and most of the royal court, which were sent back to Assyria as hostages. Now, that's a possible fulfillment of that, but I think when this prophecy of Isaiah in verse 4, Isaiah 20, was fulfilled was when Ashurbanipal executed what is called in history the Sack of Thebes. Thebes, of course, is the major Egyptian city at the southern part of the Nile in Upper Egypt. We read this from Wikipedia. This happened in 663. The city itself, that's Thebes, was conquered, smashed as if by a flood storm, and heavily plundered in the Sack of Thebes. The event is not mentioned in Egyptian sources, but is known from the Assyrian annals, which report that the inhabitants were deported. The Assyrians took a large booty of gold, silver, precious stones, clothes, horses, fantastic animals, as well as two obelisks covered in electrum, weighing 2,500 talents, 75.5 tons, which is amazing. Electrum is a mixture of silver and gold. Now, Wikipedia mentions that the Sack of Thebes is mentioned in Nahum 3, verses 8 through 10, which I will read. Are you better than Thebes that sat along the Nile with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, the river her wall? Cush and Egypt were her endless source of strength. Put and Libya were among her allies. That's to the west of Egypt on the Mediterranean coast, the cities, the countries there, were among Egypt's allies. Yet she, that's Cush in Egypt, it's called Cush in Egypt because there was an Ethiopian monarch on the throne of Egypt, and thus the two countries were basically one country. Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Her children were also dashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her dignitaries, and all her nobles were bound in chains. Now, the commentator Kaufman says that this prophecy of Isaiah in Isaiah 20, verse 4, is fulfilled this way, quote, "The prophecy regarding the carrying away of captives from Ethiopia and Egypt was fulfilled in the tremendous overthrow of the coalition by Ashurbanipal in 663, when Noamon, the same as Thebes, was brutally destroyed and large numbers of captives deported. The prophecy of Nahum has a remarkably graphic account of this crucial victory of Assyria against Egypt and Ethiopia." So I think that we are going to say that Isaiah chapter 20, verse 4 was fulfilled in the sack of Thebes by Ashurbanipal of Assyria in 663 B.C. Now, why were these captives who were sent to Assyria from Thebes? Why did they have their buttocks bared? Well, that's shameful. They went with buttocks bared to Egypt's shame. It was shameful. It's shameful even today. I hate to walk around somewhere with my buttocks bared. Of course, there's a lot of women today wearing thong bikinis who don't seem to have a problem with it. But, of course, we live in a perverted era. We're not as civilized as the Egyptians were. We go now to Isaiah chapter 20, verses 5 through 6, and we will finish this chapter. "Those who trusted in Cush and boasted in Egypt will be afraid and put to shame. In that day, the people who live on this coast will say, 'See what has happened to those we relied on, those we fled to for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. How then can we escape?'" Well, who was it that trusted in Cush that will be afraid and put to shame, as Isaiah says in verse 5? John Gill suggests it was those Jews who were looking for help against Assyria, the ones that Isaiah is so concerned about. Don't put your trust in Egypt. I think, however, that Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is right. He says it's the Philistines who trusted in Cush. They were trying to get an alliance with Cush, if you recall. Didn't work. They didn't get it, and they got whopped. Well, whether it's the people of Judah or the people of Philistia who trusted in Cush and boasted in Egypt, it really doesn't matter, because if it's the Philistines, and I believe it was, that were pointed out by Isaiah here as people who are going to be put to shame for trusting in Egypt and Cush, that was used as an object lesson for the people of Judah who were thinking about allying with Egypt and Cush. Now, Isaiah was not happy with Egypt. We read in Isaiah 30, verse 7, "Egypt's help is completely worthless. Therefore, I call her Rahab who just sits." That's a great slam. And this is even though Judah is now a subordinate ally of Assyria. But Hezekiah was scared of maintaining that alliance. He was thinking about going down to Egypt. And again, Isaiah is trying to stop it. And he's saying, look, you trust in Cush, you boast in Egypt, you're going to be afraid and put to shame. "See what has happened to those we relied on," they'll say. That's the Philistines and Ashdod. "We thought they were going to come help us, but they didn't. Those we fled to for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. Sargon II's coming, but we go down to Egypt. They didn't help us. How can we escape?" Well, you can't escape. That's it. It's over. So, Isaiah is saying to Hezekiah and all who will listen, what is the point of allying yourself with Egypt / Cush? Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this short chapter, which unfortunately turned out to be very difficult. We are now ready to go in our next audio to Isaiah chapter 21, which I will call Fallen. Fallen is Babylon. Sounds like the book of Revelation. I hope you stay tuned for our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.